Today's the first day of summer vacation for us.
Oh.
So all my kids are home.
And oh, we have.
Well, no. That's not a bad thing. Oh, no.
No, we're taking you away. That's what I meant. Like,
No. They're all still asleep.
Oh, okay.
That's the thing. Like, at 9 o'clock in the morning on the first day of summer vacation, no, they are all in bed. Mm. But we also have two house guests who are making my dogs bark, apparently, right now. Yeah, so we have, like, people in town for graduations, and then my sister-in-law is here, and, you know, so there's quite a bit going on. And we're recording on Monday instead of Wednesday, like normal, this week. So just, you know. I'm going to be messed up all week long because our day has changed.
Everything's all discombobulated.
Yeah, but it'll be all right. It's weird, though. It's the first week of summer break for us, and it's like 65 degrees. It is not
I know. It hasn't summery. Gotten hot yet. It has not gotten hot yet here.
It's strange. It's very strange. And so, like, my sister-in-law is from Florida, so she came up here, and we were like, yeah, you know, we'll be in the pool, and we'll go on hikes and stuff. And it was like raining and 60 degrees yesterday, and today it's gonna rain all week, and it's gonna be kind of weird. But
is the pool ready?
No.
Oh
no, because of the rain, because we've had so much rain. So here's the deal, they started digging, we started planning to do this pool in September, that we started talking to them and, like, figured out the, you know, all the details about
it. There's a lot to it.
And you, at least here, if you want a pool, you have to wait in line. Because there are only a couple of pool companies that are reputable, and a lot of people, post-COVID, a lot of people have just wanted to put pools in. And so we started talking to them in September, and the whole thing was, like, you're next in line. You came at a perfect time. We will start you as soon as we finish up this previous one. So by the time we got everything decided on and down payment down and all that type of stuff, it was January 15th is when we started. And those guys came out and started working, and it was 3 degrees outside. Like, for a week straight, they came out and they worked in this ridiculously cold weather. Just prepping, like, they had to break up concrete. You know, we had a driveway in our backyard. They, like, had to take all that out and everything. And then it snowed, and then it rained, and then it snowed, and it sat there for like a month, and they couldn't do anything because it was just, they'd torn everything up, and then it was just mud and slush. And we have red clay where I live, so everything is a mess. It's not like normal dirt. It is get on everything, stick on everything forever, red clay. And anyways, they've just been like working around the weather since January. We'll have weeks of rain, and then it'll dry out enough for them to get a day's worth of work in. And then we had to wait for a long time on where we put the pool. We were like ready to go. And this was another thing that took a long time. They came out and flagged it. You know, you call 811, and they come flag all the utilities and everything. And the main electrical line running from the box to our house went diagonally across the pool. So it's like here, and the line was just, there was no way around it. You couldn't move anything except for the line. So then we had to wait.
Could you have left it in there as like a thing for the kids to like swim down and touch?
Yeah. And cover it in pool noodles and like it'll be fine.
Yeah, wrap it in a lot of black tape.
Yeah. So we had to wait a long time on that, and then they had to dig a trench, and then they had to move the line, and you know, so it's been one thing after another, but mostly the weather. So for almost 6 months now, we've been like in this process, and the team that's doing it is fantastic. Like, they're, it's not them being lazy or anything at all. They're awesome. It's just taken a really long time. So now we're at a point where the pool is in place, the deck is poured. Somebody dropped the ball on ordering the liner that goes into it. Like, somebody didn't approve the final yes, make it thing. And so last week they were like, okay, cool, go get the liner box. And there was no liner box. So they had to then, like, fast track that order, and we're waiting on that to come in. It's close, man. It's real close. But it's actually fine that it...
That liner box, is that fiberglass?
No. It's a vinyl liner that's dropped into... So the shell of it is, they dug the hole, and then they put in steel panels around the top, and we have a deep end. So then they poured grout in the bottom. They put a pad at the very, very bottom. Then they poured in a layer of grout and, like, smoothed that from the pad at the bottom up into the steel walls. And that is not waterproof in any way whatsoever, but it is the shape for them to drop a big plastic bag in, basically, and it snaps in around the outside, and then they fill that with water. So that's,
have you looked into the evolution of in-ground pools, like how they were made, like 50 years ago compared to now?
Yeah, it's pretty wild, and the technologies have changed so much. There was a house that my aunt grew up in, a house that was kind of a historical home here in town, and it was, at the time, it was a really big home for this area, right? And it was the first house in town to get an in-ground pool, and this was more than, I don't even know, it was a long time ago. It was way before you got in-ground pools, right? And it was a, if I remember correctly, it was a dome shape, like an upside-down dome. And I think what I had heard that they did is they took the top off of a silo, like the, you know.
Like a grain silo?
Yeah. They took the top off, and then they dug a hole, and they flipped it over and put that in, and then, like, covered the inside of that with concrete. And, like, pool, done. And so that was there until a few years ago, somebody we know bought that house. And completely renovated it and turned it into this awesome art space and stuff. But they ended up filling in the pool. So this kind of weird historic pool. But yes, it's changed a whole lot over the years. And it changes based on where you live. So we were in Savannah. We had a pool. And it was a gunite pool. Like the typical 80s, when you think of like an 80s swimming pool with the blue slide and, you know, the all the typical stuff. It was that pool. And I think those are called gunite. Generally, it's just the type of stuff they spray on the inside to give it the structure. But you can't do that here because of the freeze. So the temperature fluctuation throughout the seasons here cracks those.
Oh.
And there's no way to make them, or it's not efficient to make them thick enough to not crack or something to that effect. So they just don't do that here anymore.
So is the liner that you're putting in over the steel, is that susceptible? Or is that the type of thing that needs to be maintenance or changed? Or
it, I think it's like a 15-year, has a 15-year warranty or something like that. It's a long, long time. And so it will eventually have to be changed because, you know, UV is going to break down everything eventually. Plus the chemicals. I mean, we're doing a saltwater pool, so that is far less abrasive on stuff than just like straight chlorine. That's actually a pretty amazing process, too. I don't know if you know anything about saltwater pools.
No.
So, you know, historically, chlorine, like, you dump this pretty rough chemical into the water, and it just kills all the stuff except for people.
That's what it smelled like growing up.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it smelled like growing up. We had an above-ground pool, and my dad would just kill the water with
chlorine. Yeah, it's just bleach, basically. You know,
our shirts would be different colors. Our hair would be lighter.
Your hair would be lighter, yep. Yeah. You get green hair at the end of the summer because it's, like, so, yeah. So with the salt pools, there's, and I don't know all the specific science, so don't yell at me if you're listening, but there's this, like, ionizer, this tube that has a plate on the inside of it, and you put this in line. So you cut out a section of pipe, you put this thing in, and as the water flows through it, the water, you add salt to the water, and it's like a tenth of the salinity of the ocean, so it's just barely salty to taste. But as this goes, this water goes over these electrified plates, they pull the sodium, like, off out of the salt water, and they break the chloride and the sodium, and so the chlorine stays in the water, but it's in a low dose and it's, like, localized in this little tube. So as it breaks those two things apart, the sodium attaches to the metal plate, the chlorine is then released into the water and disinfects it right there in that tube. And so it's like a little, it's like the cleaning happens in a little container.
It's like a
that
filter,
is then being shot into the pool, and so it's just constantly cycling through. And so really all you have to do with those is you just add big 40-pound bags of salt. I mean, you also have to, you know, make sure that's pH balance and there's some other stuff, but you don't dump in chlorine and stuff. You just add salt to the pool, and it takes care of itself. It's pretty cool. I mean, much easier to take care of. But anyway, yes, we are getting a salt pool. It's not here yet, which is fine because it's 60 degrees outside and we would be using it anyway.
Yeah. Is it ever going to be warm enough to dump in the pool?
Yeah. Soon.
Will you get like a heated cover for it or anything?
Yeah, we actually are getting a heater for it because a friend of ours has a pool in this area. She said, and the pool people confirm this, basically if you get a heater, you have 2 more months of use every year. You know, like you have a month on each end of the season. And then we have this, we're getting an auto cover, which is an extremely expensive thing to add. Extremely expensive. Like, it's one of those, it rolls up underneath the diving board area, and then you push a button and it rolls out to cover the whole thing.
That's so cool, though. How convenient is that?
Yeah. But the reason that I could justify that ridiculous expense is because they actually showed a graph of how quickly it pays for itself. Because when you open and close it, you only open it when you're swimming. You're saving heat and the chemical change from, like, the evaporation and just atmospheric stuff.
This might be to a lesser degree, but it's also extremely safe. You don't have to worry about animals falling in it.
Yep.
Animals could, like, literally walk over it, couldn't they?
Yeah.
Technically.
Yeah. Yeah. You can walk across it. It's not tight, but it's, you know, it's, you can walk in it and get wet, but you're not going to, like, go under the water. So we just decided, you know, because we're looking ahead at, like, this is for our grandkids too, which is hopefully really far from now. But at the same time, if we're going to do this, we may as
do this,
you know? Yeah. And so we're looking ahead at what it's going to be like to have in the short term. We want our kids to, like, bring all of their friends. We want our house to be this place where everybody comes and spends time and is safe and is, you know. And then eventually we want it to be a place where all the grandkids and all the family comes and all that. So that's the stuff we're looking ahead with. Mm-hmm. That's kind of why we did it. I mean, we wanted one. It's fun, but it's, like, stupid expensive to do. But the justification was, like, we're investing in community. Mm-hmm. Like, our kids' community, our family community, our local neighborhood community, you know. So that's kind of why we're doing it.
But that's cool.
Not that anybody asked that, but that's why we're doing it. I have to justify it to myself because it is so much money.
Right.
So much money.
You know what?
So much money.
Enjoy it while you can.
Absolutely.
You know my theory. Just spend it while you got it. You can't take it with you.
Well, I also have 4 kids to put through college.
Yeah,
so
yeah, they'll be fine.
But I was talking to my neighbor has a pool. And I've known them since I was very young. Like, I've known them probably my whole life. And their grandkids are my kids' age. And so I was talking to them one time. I was, like, asking them questions about the pool because they let us come over and swim stuff sometimes. And he said, well, you know, we put it in too late. We put the pool in when our grandkids were in high school, which means we got, like, a couple of years of them enjoying it and coming over to hang out at our house and stuff. And now they're on to other things and they're going to college. And we only got a few good years of using it. He was like, if you're going to do it now while your youngest is still going to be at home for a few years and, like, make the most of, you know. So that's part of why we just decided to go ahead and pull the trigger, you know. And it's an investment for sure. That will not pay for itself. I'll be clear about that. It's one of those things you pay for. It's not going to be like, it's not going to raise the property value.
Oh, it doesn't.
Well, I mean, it does, but not to an equal amount of what you're spending.
Gotcha.
Because some people see a pool as a liability when they buy a home. So it's not that. But there's just so many other things that you can invest in that are not financial. So that is kind of
at the graveyard house, there's this odd little bungalow awkwardly placed in the backyard, and everybody always asked me, what is it for? I said, I don't know. So I owned the house for about 6 months when finally the neighbor came over to me and said, that's the pool house. There used to be an in-ground pool right in front of that. I was like, how many years ago? He's like, oh, they covered it up in the 80s. So there's an in-ground pool buried in my backyard.
Dig it out, man.
No, there is zero no. evidence. There's, like, no evidence of it. There's not a depression. There's nothing. They probably pushed everything into the hole and just filled it with dirt. But right where the house is, there's this cute little, looks like a little yoga shack or something. Could be a good pottery house, but the roof needs to be repaired. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, oh, that's the pool house. Now all the neighbors who know it's mine, they're like, what are you going to do with the pool house? I'm like, nothing. I don't know. I got to build the house itself first.
I'm going to put a bug in your ear because you're going to want to dig that up.
Okay. Tell me why.
Because I would almost guarantee you, with your luck and all the weird stuff that you find in all the weird places around you, you're going to dig that up and you're going to be like, huh, somebody filled this pool with old bandsaws or some weird Cadillac or something. And then you're going to be like, oh, look what I found that nobody else has ever had before. Yeah, you should dig it up. I mean, that would be amazing if you started digging and you're just like...
Remind me to tell you what I bought this week.
Oh, no.
After I graduated high school, my mom and stepdad bought... They moved into a new house that had a kidney bean in-ground pool. And so for a couple of years, I got to go over... I mean, it was still like a 40-minute drive over there, but I would go over there once in a while and go swimming. And then my mom and stepdad got a divorce, and stepdad was like, I don't want to take care of a pool anymore, and it is now a garden. It is filled with dirt and... No longer usable.
Yeah. I mean, it is a lot of work to take care of them. And if you're not, like, invested in it, I can see that for sure. You could also turn it into a pond. You just, like, let it go, you know?
Let it go, yeah.
Yeah, go get some goldfish and throw them in there, and you're good to go.
Nature will take over.
Yep. Anyway, so that's been a big part of the last several months for us, is just kind of watching that go along and trying to... make decisions. There's a lot of decisions that go with something like that, so and that's not our specialty. So anyway, what have you guys been doing?
Well, I told you guys that I bought something. Can you guess what you think? Try and make a guess what you think I bought this week.
It's a Cadillac with a bandsaw attached to the back of it.
No, so I did some research, and the last time I bought a Chevy square body was four to 5 years ago. So it's been a long time. So don't get on me what I'm about to tell you. I'll text you pictures of it. I bought a project for father and son project for me and Rob. I've been wanting for a long time a tow truck. So this tow truck came up. It's close. It's about 30 miles away. It's a 1984 Chevy, or rather a GMC, but the same shape. It's a 1984 GMC Sierra tow truck that hasn't been used in probably 20 years. It's been sitting. It's like that crossover between like old and modern. It's that in between. You know, the 80s is like that in between where you open up the engine compartment and it's still just full of stuff. You don't know what it is. So it's that. But I'm fairly confident we can get it running. It's a diesel. It was cheap. It was $2,500, and it's a 4x4 GMC 3500 with a Holmes wrecking body on the back. There's three guys that are like fist bumping because they know what that means, and it's got all hydraulics in the back and everything. So it's going to be a project car.
And it runs?
No.
Oh.
No. He said it ran once. This guy.
Of course it ran once.
I think I have it bad, and then I go to visit some guy like this who's got 50 cars in this muddy field. I'm like, what do you do? He's like, oh, this is his collection. He's not a mechanic or anything. I said to Rob, I'm like, what does that guy do? He goes, I don't know. He goes, he's not a mechanic, that's for sure. I'm like, he's not a mechanic? He goes, no, he says he did something else. This is his list of things to do. And he said he needs to raise some money, and his landlord is telling him to clean up the yard. I'm like, he doesn't even own that property? There's like 25 cars stuck in the mud. And anyway, I ended up making a deal with the guy. I'm going to pick it up after my Ohio trip. So there'll be some Instagram and some stories on it. I'll send you guys pictures. I'm so excited to get this thing and start fixing it. Like Rob said, after dealing with the Cadillac, your threshold for pain or your tolerance for pain goes up and up and up. I look at this thing. He says it's going to need new gas tanks, and you could see a little gap between the cab of the truck and the wrecker body, and you look down and you can look right into the gas tank. There's like a rotted hole right through the top, and it's just full of leaves and muck. I'm like, oh yeah, look, Rob, I go, we're gonna need a new gas tank. And it takes two gas tanks, so it's gonna need two gas tanks.
You gonna make your own gas tank? Because I know you were talking recently about making that.
I'll probably buy it, because when it comes to these square bodies from the all of them, pretty much any kind of Chevy truck, but as far as the square bodies go from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, every part is readily available. You could almost build an entirely new car off of LMC. Every single part is available. So it'll go on. The gas tanks are probably like $150 a piece.
Oh, yeah.
So they're not too bad. But besides that, my other car is the Woody, though. I'm showing you guys pictures of the Woody. The Woody's really coming together. Episode 3 posted this weekend. It's doing well. Really, really nice comments. And in the old days, I would always get stuff to do on the vlogs. But this time around, I asked 2 videos ago, send me license plates to pass the floor. And I got so many license plates from all around the world. I got license plates from Aruba and other places. And what I'm going to do is line the whole inside of the car, all the interior, with license plates, all the part that I build. So there's going to be plenty of license plates. So this is going to be way more than I need for the floor. So I'm going to incorporate them one way or another. Hmm. Build the inner wheel wells with them and stuff. It's going to be fun.
That's cool.
So the car video's out, and I'm excited. Now I'm at that point now, because now I've built 2 boats. I'm at that point now where every free moment, I should not be scrolling. I should be gluing wood to this thing. So it's going to be that moment of like, after dinner, like, what are you going to do? Oh, I'm going to go out to the shop and glue wood for about an hour. What are you going to do this afternoon? I'm probably going to glue wood for about an hour. Because you got to glue it, clamp it, wait. Glue it, clamp it, wait. So that's the next few months. But it's running, driving, and I took the gas tank out. So in the video, you see me move it with the tractor, but that's only because I took the gas tank out to safely weld in the back.
So I have a question about that whole, that the wooden part of that. Mm-hmm. I know it's attached to a steel, like the connection points are steel. Mm-hmm. The question is, though, you're still going to have like flex, not mm-hmm. frame flex, but the whole car flexes.
I would imagine, I'm probably going to.
So how does that going to work with the, like, is the wood understructure separated enough from?
No.
Like, I don't really know how to ask that. Gonna, how rigid is that connection?
I'm pretty confident I'm going to get cracks and snaps. It's I'm not going to drive this to the West Coast, so I'm not overly concerned. It's kind of more of a showpiece. This kind of leans a little bit into our topic for the day, but I'm not going to be too concerned about if it's going to crack and flex and break. Most likely it will. The steel frame, I think, is going to make up for a lot of it, because I made the steel frame, welded it to the frame that would have been part of the actual body. So when I got the car, it was completely cut all the way off right at the back of the driver's seat over. There was nothing. So I attached to the sheet metal frame of the actual body of the car this network of pipes and tubes and welded those all together and then rubber mounted them to the actual frame that carries the wheels and the gas tank and the engine. So I mimicked the way that it would have been. And then I welded up these tubes. They're all attached to the car itself, the upper body. So in a way, I mimicked how it would have been manufactured. I just have to let go and let God as far as if it's going to twist and crack and that type of stuff. Okay. Flex and crack, I should say. If it does, I'm sure it's not going to pop apart. I'm going to do what you might consider like a hurricane strap. You know how you have a hurricane strap where you have straps of steel that go from like your wooden walls down to your foundation. So I'm going to do a lot of stuff like that, where the wood that's wrapped over the metal is also extra bolted on. I've been looking for spots to conceal nuts and bolts and welds and stuff. So I'm not overly worried.
Yeah.
And if it cracks, I know a guy that knows how to fix stuff. So.
That's true.
Where I live, I have no idea what a hurricane strap is, but from your brief explanation, I think I got a good idea.
When you ever see how a roof just literally picks up and blows off of a house? That's because when the rafters hit the top of the walls, they just toenail it in with the sideways nails or the angled nails. That's how you would do it for years, because what's the roof going to go?
Gravity's
holding it in place. Yeah. But when the wind picks up, the whole roof just goes whoop. So they put these steel straps, they nail them to the rafters and then bring them down to the walls and nail them to the walls. And if you do that at every rafter, you have all this insurance. And then you also need that to go from the wall to the foundation.
Yeah.
I'm sure someone's yelling at their computer going, that's not the right explanation.
No, I mean, that's the way you do it. My friend Bert built a really nice workshop, like shed thing in his backyard in Savannah when I lived there. And that was one of the things that he, when the inspector came out, that was one of the things that they pointed out. Like, there, you have to have this many hurricane straps around the foundation and to connect the roof and stuff. And that was the first I had heard of it, because I didn't grow up down there, so I didn't know that either.
Seems like a relatively new thing, like in the last 30 years. It's something that I remember hearing obviously because of down in the south, things blow away a lot. But between that, and I'm excited to really, I haven't sent you a picture of the tow truck yet. I'll do that in a minute, but the tow truck is going to be fun. It's just another, it involves electronics, which I'm learning more about as far as the car system go, and hydraulics. The whole back has several levers and shift knobs. It's the previous 10 or 15 years, so if you're looking at like the 70s, maybe obviously the 60s, tow trucks would have this like cranky thing. You'd turn a crank to lift up the car in some cases. This was like the next gen where they started using hydraulics. So I'll get a basic understanding of that. And it's a diesel. It's a 6.2 diesel. So it's the same engine that I already have in my army truck. So I have a little experience with that. He said he bought it to fix up, started it one day off of a gas can, and then never ran it again. Said he got too busy. So my buddy Dave, who's my mechanic consigliere, said that as long as the lower half doesn't have any problems, you should be fine. That would include the crankshaft and the pistons and stuff. So as long as that stuff is good, everything else is easy to fix.
So how many trucks is that now?
I never counted.
Yes, you did. You know exactly how many it is.
I really don't. I can guess it's about 7. I'll do a count while we talk.
Okay. That's funny.
But this is going to be fun because I know Scott Crabtree listens, and Scott and I talked about doing a project and it just never got around to it. So, but this might be the one where we do a fake sticker on it so it looks old. I mean, it doesn't. It actually looks like, when you take first glance, it looks like a good brand new truck, but it's not at all.
Interesting.
So I'll send you pictures.
Cool.
But yeah, that's it.
And David, what did you buy this week?
Nothing. Okay. Absolutely nothing. I told you, I did go to the grocery store and I bought groceries. And while waiting in line, I did not use my phone. I thought about you and I was like, all right, I'm just going to stand here and suffer.
Was it terrible or was it nice?
I mean, you know, the person in front of me wrote a check and it took them. You know how long it takes to write it. I was perfectly fine. It's a new me, so I'm gonna work on that a lot more. It hasn't been that many days since our last podcast, since we're recording very early, so there's not a lot of new things to talk about. I'm still putting the shop together. I have been moving what I can by myself from Kelly's garage into my garage, and then my brother's coming over tomorrow. And we'll finish moving the other stuff in, and I'll have a new shop. So that is basically what I'm working on. And I am redoing a lot of the shop furniture, where previously when I made my miter saw station, I wanted lots of depth, 30 inches of depth for places to put stuff. Turns out I don't need that many places to put stuff. I need more floor space mostly for tripods and lights and stuff, because there's right now, or at least previously before we tore the shop together, you couldn't move a camera tripod and a light tripod down the same aisle. I'm going to gain a few inches just by making the benches a little bit smaller. It's going to make life a little bit easier. I've come up with a 2.0 design of shop furniture. I'm much better in Fusion now, and so I've come up with a Fusion file where I can change. Like, my old design didn't have a toe kick, and the old design also had a kind of a face frame, and if you wanted to add drawers, you would have to build out the sides so they were even with the face frame. This new design, you don't have to build out the sides for drawers, and it has a toe kick, and the Fusion file has, you can change the depth of the toe kick, the height of the toe kick, the amount of drawers, the height of the bench, the width, you can change every single parameter.
Awesome.
And, so I'm a little better at Fusion now than I was before. And so I think a while ago I was like, I'm done making videos about shop furniture and tools and stuff. I'm going to focus on creativity. But this is, I got to backtrack on that a little bit, because this is something I need. I think I've come up with a better version that could help some people. So I probably have a couple shop furniture videos coming up in my near future.
People love that.
Love that. Yes. Yeah. I've been trying to train people to love my project videos instead. But people want shop furniture. And I think I am, you know, we set up that second shop over at the other house, all budget tools. I think I'm going to try to use the budget tools to make the shop furniture. I think that'll be more valuable to the people. So I'm going to use my Wen track saw and circular saw and try to do it the hard way.
You're not going to use your $10,000 worth of tools to make your...
Yeah. I know.
Yeah. I got that comment again this week.
Oh, yeah.
This week.
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, man. Just crazy. I had some really... Not to get on comments, but I've had some really, really out there comments in the last couple of, I don't know, week or 2 weeks or something. And it's not a lot of them, but like just... really out there, and there's things I almost don't even want to talk about specifically because in the after show I'll tell you one of the ones that was very like it was frustrating, not to me personally, it was frustrating that somebody would say that out loud, you know. I was just like, oh, come on. But anyway.
Did you say what you wanted to say about the comments?
Yeah, I'm done with that.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
I over my last number of videos, I've gotten so many comments saying, you know, these are your best videos, I like this style, I like the storytelling, like what you're doing is fantastic, and those comments make me feel so good, but the numbers don't correlate with the comments. And that
goes
back, it is interesting, it goes back onto packaging. Thumbnails and titles are so freaking hard, and if you don't have a hook and you just want to make something because you need something, it's difficult to sell that to get people to watch.
I'm feeling that right now too, for sure. Yeah, it's weird, and I don't know the solution for it, or like, I mean, there's not a solution for it, but I don't know the thing that I'm missing, you know, that I could do better at. So specifically, you can say thumbnails, titles, yeah, sure, but what about them? Like, what is the hook? What is the thing that actually would? Because even what I think is a hook, it's not necessarily a hook for the viewers, you know.
Yeah, I have no formulation for it. It makes no sense. I did notice in my comments for episode 3 of the Cadillac, I did get a few people like, "Wow, I'm hooked. I've subscribed." I liked one or two people even said, "I saw this thumbnail. I was like, I had to click on it." It's just a dynamic picture of the back of the car with no posts or anything before I did any of the wood. But for the first time, I've noticed, and there was a couple of other comments that insinuate this is a first-time watcher. And I've never seen it. I've got at least 5 that I kind of noticed in passing. And the first time, really like it, I'm subscribed, which is great. So if this video can do that, obviously that's great. Mm-hmm. But usually my subscriber count is in the negative.
Yeah, I'm in the negative still in my latest video, too.
It's like, what?
Yeah, usually I get a dip, you know, we talked about this. I'll get a dip at first and then it will come back, and it's
I think at least YouTube purges, they get rid of bot accounts.
They do, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I don't think there's too many people going in there going, you know what, I'm sick of this guy making stuff.
Like, oh, I'm pretty sure though. I get that.
There are some. Oh, you're using a Capex? Unsubscribed.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The video wasn't about the miter saw.
Remember that time you made that thing? Why aren't you making that again? Unsubscribe. Yeah. Sorry, I've already made
it. I liked you better when you lived at your mother's house.
Yeah. So, well, let's see. For me, I like you said, David, it hasn't been that long since we recorded. So I really haven't done a whole lot. I've been working on this metal inlay. I don't remember if I talked about that in the last show or not, but this metal inlay in wood thing. And It's another one of those that I don't know how to make a thumbnail out of. I don't know how to hook people into watching it, but I really want people to watch it because I think it's a clever thing. But, yeah, I'm going to have to figure that out. And I really have just been doing that, and it's been graduation weekend around here, so lots of things to do with... My kids aren't graduating yet, but lots of friends are and stuff. So we've had a lot of things to go to and a lot of soccer games and stuff, so I really haven't done, you know, a whole lot of interesting stuff. But I've got a couple of things coming up in the next month that are like two projects that are tied together that are home improvement but cool but interesting and I think visual, and I'm trying to figure out how to package those before I get started on them, which I think is a better idea and something I don't always do, but trying to think ahead, you know, like, what can I get before I do the work, especially because it's a home improvement, I have the before image. What can I get that will help make that hook more visible, more a visual thing that somebody can see a transition or something like that? And I just have a hard time with that. It's like, it's a lot to think about, you know, designing and building the project and how you shoot the video, and then to also think ahead. It's the same conundrum that everybody has, but people who don't make content may not realize how many things you were trying to think of at the same time, you know, before we get started.
So my next video is going to be the shop renovation, fixing the floors. And I didn't plan on making a video when we started. And that means I didn't take really good photos along the way. And so I have no idea what I'm going to do for that. And
Take a shop picture that you have and just put it in Liquify and just make it crazy.
Just make it all drippy and
Just say my floor is out of whack. And, you know, basically, yeah. Just say I couldn't photograph it, but this is how it feels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Like, get the emotion of a thing across instead of like the visual of a thing across.
You see, no matter, like, I'm having a hard time photographing the Woody. Every time I photograph it, it like straightens out lines that are more dynamically curved and pitched. Every time, you know, I'm like, it looks like a giant hunk of wood on the back of this frame. It doesn't quite look like that in person. Every time I take a picture of it, it just magnifies everything. So I took a video for Patreon, which I didn't post yet. I guess I forgot until just this minute. But I described how right now it doesn't have any horizontal lines to break up the big, it looks like a giant loaf of bread. So by putting these horizontal lines, and some are going to be filled in with wood, some are going to be windows, it's really going to break up this giant loaf of bread, which is, I'm like, this looks like a big loaf of bread with a nose of a car on it. But I think the lines will change that, and every time I photograph it or videotape it, that's all it looks like. But
I got to write that down as a title. Hang on just a second.
So we did have a topic.
Yep. So, no, the loaf of bread with a car on it. That's the title. Emotion. Come on.
So this morning on my personal Discord, I asked if anybody had any topics, and Dad Droid responded with, "How do you decide where the good enough finish line is on a project? We all want perfection, but sometimes it isn't practical or is wild overkill. And is it different based on use case, the person it's for, etc.?" So deciding the finish line.
I talk about it in my episode 3 of the car, is that I'm not getting so deep into all this joinery. If you look at a 1940s Woody, there's finger joints and there's mortise and tenons, and there's lots of joinery, I've noticed, because I've studied the course. I can't do that because I'm building completely in the dark. I don't have a design to go by. I haven't laid it out perfectly. I'm just building by feel. The body that's existing is dictating the body lines that aren't there. So I'm putting these long strips of string and wood and seeing where that lands in the back. And I came to the realization of, don't get so uptight. Just start laminating wood. You could take it away. You could add it again later if you look back. Like, for instance, the pictures I just sent you guys. If you notice, the mid pillar, the one that's in front of the rear wheel, does not parallel with the pillar behind the original door. And I'm gonna adjust that so those pillars are parallel. Because right now, one is angle forward 5 or 10 degrees, the other one's perfectly straight up and down, and it doesn't look good to me. So stepping back and looking at that, I'm going to correct that. And all these little nuances, I realize I'm making a video. This really, more than anything, the finished result will be the video. The car will be a real car. You can come up and touch and see it, but I'm not going to get too wrapped up in all this joinery. So when I first started adding wood, I'm like, that's it, I'm just going to glue this to that. And I had to go through this emotional realization, like, yeah, you just glue stuff onto it. What else is there? There's no magical joint. Every once in a while, I'm burying a screw underneath a piece of laminated wood. I'm like, okay, there's enough laminate there. There's glue joints between the metal and the wood. Let me just put some screws in, and then the next piece of wood will cover the screw heads. So I'm doing that as well. But I'm not getting uptight anymore. In the beginning, I was like, what if I do this wrong? It doesn't matter if I do it wrong, because the fans will tell me what I'm doing wrong. There'll be the one woody restorer guy out there. They'll give me some guidance. Usually super pros are nice. They're not nitpicky. You know, super pros in all of our comment sections are the ones that give you the most kind guidance. And you look at it, the comment, and you're like, wow, I just totally did it wrong, but now I know the right way to do it without an insult.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I'm always kind of fishing for those too. But, you know, and it also obviously depends on, I have to do a client job this week. I have to do a display for a whiskey barrel for Don Julio. And in that case, I'll make sure it looks as perfect as it can be. But then there's also the checklist of, okay, the designer, this 3D CGI design that I got, these are the several, not a lot, few things that they want. These are the several things. Have I met each one of these criteria? I ask myself, when, especially when it's for a client, I was like, okay, they wanted this, they wanted that, they wanted that. What else is there? That's it. I've made the requirements. I've made my best aesthetic choices for the things they didn't ask for. And they always come to me because they say I'm always on brand with my builds. And I just have to trust the process.
I have a... In my latest video, I made a pair of bedside lamps. And the base of the bedside lamps is 3D printed. And it was the thing that I wanted to add on at the last second. I knew the lamps needed one more little thing to fulfill the satisfaction of it looking complete. And I came up with this 3D base. And it's a pretty wide base that's flat on the bottom. And one of my issues with 3D printing is I do not like seeing 3D print lines. So I wanted to print it in a very fine resolution. Sorry, I don't know the terms. The line height. And so you wouldn't see them. And when I printed my test one, came out fine. All right, now I'm gonna do a little finer line height. And the corners of it kept coming up during the 3D print, even though I'm using one of the beds with the grip. Again, I don't know what I'm talking about. but, you know, it would be like a multi-hour long print. And then when it fails at the end, it's always frustrating. And so I'm like, okay, there is this other bed that I can get that's a super grip. I can also get some glue. I'll just order both. But in the meantime, I need to finish up this dang video. So I am just going to 3D print one where you can see the lines, and I will replace it in the future. And I promised myself I will replace them in the future. But in the final shots of the lamps, you don't get to see the detail of the 3D print. And I have printed one. I've got one that came out perfectly. But... yeah, sometimes you just have to say, this is good enough for now. If I want to come back to it, I will come back to it later.
Yeah, so two things. One, yes, I totally agree with you, and I have to do that on a regular basis. Because our schedule, we have to, you know, we have to get videos like moving along, so because we have the next one we have to get to, and there's tied to sponsors, and sometimes we just have to do that. I envy the people who are just doing stuff for the love of it and can really... You just take the time that they really want to take with it. The other thing is, when you have a print like that, sometimes, I don't know that shape in particular, but sometimes changing the print orientation can get rid of those lines, and even if it makes the print take a little bit longer, you mm-hmm. have a higher success rate with a different orientation, or breaking it into two pieces so that you can print it in a different orientation if the, you know, geometry. So there are some ways around that sometimes if you want to hide those lines without just having to make them finer.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah. But anyway. Yeah, I mean, as far as like the, you know, where that line is on, you know, when it's done, for me, that is, it's constantly moving because... At the beginning of a project, ideal of what is good enough on that particular project is always pretty high. And then as I get closer to it, it probably pulls back a little bit, you know, because it gets more realistic and I've started applying time to it and how much effort I've put into something already. And then I think the good thing for me is that most of the things that I make are things that are in my house, are things that I use, are things that I'm surrounded by all the time. And so if there is something that is really not good enough or really should be better, it's close enough to me that it will irritate me until I fix it or I improve it or whatever. And if it's not enough to irritate me into fixing it or improving it, then I think it's good enough. You know what I mean? Like there are this desk right here in front of me, there is a little spot right, literally right in front of me where I thought I had it sanded well enough. But it was when I sanded it, these little like divots in it were full of sawdust. So it felt smooth. But then when I put the finish on it, it pulled that sawdust away. And I was already in the middle of finishing it when I noticed, oh, now there's these little like texture things. And so we did right in front of my keyboard. But the effort to go through and actually like take everything off my desk, sand that down, sand it smooth, refinish it, put everything back on my desk is not worth the amount of stuff that I would have to do and the disruption that that little fix would be for me to, you know, to actually get that done.
Now, if that was for a client.
If it was for a client, it'd be a totally different scenario. Yeah. It would have never made it to this point because I wouldn't have.
You would have been much more prudent while you're working on it.
Yeah. And I wouldn't have put stuff back on the desk until I was 100% sure that it was, you know. But I just didn't really notice that in time.
So it definitely depends on who and what it's for.
Yeah, 100%.
If it's shop furniture, I spray paint on top of it, who cares?
Yeah. I am lucky enough where there's always the next project I need to make. So I need to finish this one up so I can get to the next one. I just had somebody send me an email. A very nice email over the weekend of a desk that he's been making for 3 years. And
wow.
Yeah. And not because it's a 3-year long project. It's just because life gets in the way and, you know, more important things take over. And, you know, I can't even imagine working. I think I would lose interest and I would have to just like, you know what, let's just throw some finish on it and call it a day. And so it really, I think that the good enough is very flexible. I try to have what I vision as the finished product, and I try to hit that as much as I can, but a lot of times I find myself cutting corners is a little strong, but I might be cutting corners on the sanding and finishing so I can finish this and move on because it's more satisfying to start another project, and that starting a new project is my favorite part of the project. It's just everything feels new, you know. We clean the shop real good, and it's just like always a nice fresh restart.
Yeah, I think you know what you're saying there about some things just taking a long time. I think there is a certain type of person or a certain type point in life where there's a little bit of security or relief in not finishing something. If you have this thing that like, I can keep tinkering with that. Like it doesn't have to be done. This desk can take a little bit longer. It's nice to have that thing to go to and focus on because it's not the rest of your responsibility and it's not the rest of your work and stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for some people, it's probably kind of a subconscious intentional thing to not finish something. Yeah. And I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I think that is
an ongoing distraction. I know what that's
like.
Yeah,
it's a way to disconnect, you know? The other thing I was going to say is, and we've talked about this before, but my father-in-law, my stepfather-in-law, I guess, passed away years ago, but he was a contractor. Built stuff all the time. And I remember him one time, he was helping me put in windows in our house. And I remember him making the point that like his job as a home builder was to cover up the previous day's work. And that always stuck with me because it was like, you know, the first day you put up framing, and not days, but you know what I mean. You put up framing, and then you cover that in drywall, and then you cover that in mud, and then you cover that with trim, and then you cover that with caulk, and you cover that with primer, and you cover that with paint, and you cover that with caulk, and you just keep doing that,
yeah.
And you improve the previous day's work down to where the details become, like, do we really need to put another layer of caulk on the top of that baseboard? Does it matter at this point? We can, but do we need to?
Mm-hmm.
You have to cover the framing with drywall, right? You have to cover the drywall with mud, but every layer you go down becomes a little bit less impactful and less important. So you have to find where that point is that, like, it you know, okay, we're done. And that always stuck out to me because, you know, when you think about a home being built, it's really obvious. But if you're building a piece of furniture, all of those things scale down. It's still that improvement, that like stepped improvement. But sanding is a good example of that. Like, yeah, I can sand it with 120. Like, is it worth sanding it with 320 and right. 600 and 1,000? And like, you can. But I think he made the point to me that there becomes a point very quickly where it's diminishing returns. You're putting work into something that is not going to pay off, and the results are not going to be visible to
I often say you're never going to get credit for it. Like if you're building a cabinet and you paint the inside of it, or if you paint the underside or the side that faces the wall, you're never going to get credit for it. And that's like a thing that I often say if I'm working with Rob or if I'm working with anybody else. I'm like, you know what? You're not going to get credit for it. Don't bother. No one's going to care that you did that.
When you're working on something and there's the fine little details at the end, you are hyper-focused on those little details. And what you forget is when the project is done, you look at a project as a whole. You don't nitpick and look at the details. Well, we do, but the general audience for that piece of furniture doesn't look at the fine little details. They see the whole thing.
And that's the problem I'm having on the Carmagia. One of the many, many problems I'm having on the Carmagia is I have to do that on a regular basis. Jimmy, I feel like you're really good at this, at looking at a big picture of a vehicle and doing the parts that make it what you want it to be. And not necessarily, like, I've never seen your cars up close, so I'm not saying they're not detailed. I'm not saying that at all. But you know where that line is.
Yeah.
And the other day I was out at the farm and I was working on the back end of the Ghia, not making a video. I was just out there and I was like, yeah, I'm going to make a little bit of progress, right? And so the car is up on a stand. And so I am looking at the bottom of the back bottom of the car. This is going to be 8 inches from the ground. Right, and I'm looking at these two pieces, and I'm like clamping them up and trying to get the seam right before I weld it. And the bottom of this bottom piece, the lowest part closest to the ground, has a little like pinch in it. And I'm like, man, I gotta hammer that out. I gotta get rid of that little stupid thing. And I'm like hammering, and I hammer it, and it knocks the clamps out, and I have to start over. And I was like, why am I doing this?
You can also weld it and suit it out later.
Well, and yeah, that's what I should have done. Yeah. But it's going to be 5 feet below my eyes.
Yeah.
Like, who cares? Why does that matter? You know, but it's because I was looking at it from a perspective that is not the same perspective that I will look at it when it's finished, when it's on wheels, when it's rolling down the road.
Interior design and client jobs, one of the last things we would do is I'd say, like, let's just stand in the room and just look at everything we've done and where everything's going to be shadowed. Don't get too uptight. You know what I mean? Shadowed, like a visual shadow. If you're going to look at the front of a cabinet, you're not going to see the back corner of it. And to see that back corner, you need to have your back against the wall turned around. Obviously, you don't want to leave any glaring mistakes. But when you look at it, just like everything you see instantly when you walk in the room, make sure all that looks as perfect as it could look. You want everything to be good, but you want that to be the most perfect impression when somebody walks in, especially if they still owe you money.
Yeah. So I'm trying to remember with the Ghia that the perspective I have of it on the stand and the nitpicky look close up. Because when I go to car shows and I see these old cars, none of them are perfect. And if they are, they're because somebody spent, you know, $200,000 to get somebody else to do the project for them. But most of them, you can see paint chips, you can see dents in the thing, you can see where the paint wasn't perfect and that, and it's still an awesome old car, you know.
A funny story about, so when I redid the 1985 blue Chevy truck flatbed.
Truck number eight.
The blue Chevy flatbed that I got from Vice Grip Garage. I redid the cab corners and the rockers, and it's a typical thing that goes wrong on these cars. And the cab corners is this big piece that goes up, and then there's a big square piece that kind of goes behind the cab. But because this truck had a flatbed on it, and I wasn't about to remove the flatbed, I can only reach as much as I could reach. So when you look the car, you look at the car from the side, you're like, there's nothing wrong with this car. It's perfect. But when you get up and look underneath the back of the cab, these two big pieces of sheet metal are just like hanging in space because I couldn't reach to put a screw in them or anything. So they're just like, it's just like a piece of paper that like emerges out of the Bondo and the paint that just like hang in space like a fin. And I'm like, whatever, I can't get at it. So when I'm looking at this tow truck the other day, I'm going around, I said to Rob, I'm like, everything looks really good. I mean, it needs a new floor, but the rockers are really good on both sides. They look really good. And I look between the cab and the tow truck body, and I'm like, oh, it looks like Jimmy DeResta put these cab corners on. A big fin of sheet metal is hanging into nowhere as far as like he did as much as he could reach and just left them. I'm like, I laughed. I'm like, all right, I'll buy the car. This guy's nice. Like me. But whoever restored it years before this guy.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, as far as the question, you know, there is no answer. I think it's a moving target for me. I think it's moving. What is good enough, what is finished, is a moving target from when the project starts to when it finishes. And it's different for every project based on who it's for, how much time I have, you know, how much I care about it. Some things I have to do, some things I want to do. And that, I think, for me at least, pretty much it has a huge impact on where I think that finish line is, because most of the things I do are for myself. You know, I think for other people that would be a little bit different story, but yeah, I don't know. Any other thoughts on the finish line thing?
Yeah, it's really just a matter of what you feel. Yeah. Project by project. Some projects you can't wait to get to be done so you can move through it, move on from it. Some projects are the projects where you like rush to see them in the morning after you've been sleeping on them all night long. You're like,
those are my favorite. Yes.
I can't wait to do the next step. And then once it's done, you just sit looking at it going, where can I add something else? No, there's no need to. Mm-hmm. But maybe I could. No, there's no. I've got to make another one. And then you start making another one. That happens to me with when I do bookbinding and I get into those little modes where I bookbind and do the leather covers. I always, I'll make another one. Let me make another one. I'll make the improvement in the next one.
So. Nice. Cool. Well, I'm going to thank our Patreon supporters. Excuse me, because they're awesome. Oh, there he goes with his noises again. Huge thanks to everybody over at Patreon, especially our top support. Stop it. Especially our top supporters. A pretty big deal. Matthias Garnell, Crabtree Creative, Michael Menegin, Warren Works, The New Janky Workshop, Scott at Daddy Yourself DIY, Sean Beckner, Odin Leather Goods, Rich at Low End Design, Chad from Mancrafting, Works by Solo, Albers Woodworks, Corey Ward, and Nick Ryan. But also, people like Tuscarora Woodworks. Yeah, been supporting for a couple of years now. Thank you. That everybody over there at every level gets the after show, which I'll tell you about that comment that I got, and I'm sure we'll have other stuff. It's usually just like extra secret stuff. We talk for 15-20 minutes on a separate podcast feed. You only get it by going to patreon.com/makingit and supporting the show, and if you do, we would appreciate that. And if you don't, that's cool. Just glad you're here. Thanks for listening and watching. Speaking of, I think a lot of people forget that this show is on YouTube. And it is on YouTube. So if you'd rather watch or listen via YouTube, you can also just put it in the background. It's there as well. And the after show is in video, too. So if you get the after show podcast, it gives you a link to the video every week, and you can just go watch it over there if you want to. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, we appreciate you. I don't have any... I mean, I can try to find something to recommend... is not very relevant, but do you guys have anything to recommend?
While we were talking, I remembered my friend Marco La Viola from Italy. We made friends on the internet years ago, and Marco makes models, and I'm going to send you guys, but look at the models he makes. You guys follow him? He follows us, I think.
No.
Yeah, he makes little models. So, like, for instance, you see a Ferrari there. Somebody might own a Ferrari, and they want a model of their exact car, so they'll hire him to make a model. And he's made Mercedes Gullwings and the James Bond car. I'm going through here quick in here. I think this is probably a Lamborghini Tractor. Many people don't know Lamborghini was in the tractor business before they were in the sports car business. So,
yep. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, so Marco makes these incredibly perfect little models for private owners of these cars. And some 3D printing, some handmade, a little bit of combination of everything. So when do you know when you're done? This is the type of work that is incredible attention to detail. I'll send you guys this.
Cool.
So I have a couple to make up for Bob's lack of pick. It's only been a few days since our last show.
Thank you.
So my first one is from Drew at Witworks. He made a stunning looking door for his new office. It looks fantastic. It's basically, I forget what the wood is. It looks like some sort of hickory, but I forget. But he filled in parts with epoxy and then turned it into a door. Like most people would turn this into a slab table. He made it into a door. It looks amazing. The storytelling on this video is so good. And Drew is just great at helping out when I have questions, and I know he's helped you guys out as well. So it's one of his best videos. And then my other pick is Physics Girl released her first, she's on camera for the first time in over 2 years. She's been dealing with long COVID and barely could get out of bed for 2 years. And when she would get out of bed, she would have these major crashes. And there's been a breakthrough. She still has crashes, but she's talking on camera for the first time in a couple years, and you're gonna cry because it's a feel good. It's I don't even know what else to say. It's just like
She's been out of commission for a long time.
Yeah,
it's really nice to see her back. You know, on the way back. I think it's very cool. Okay, cool. Well, I do have one. Like I said, it's not relevant, but to you guys. But there's a new video game out that I have not played, but there's a trailer for it that looks really cool. And I think if you two were into video games, you would probably like this game. It's called
Defending the Tower. I keep saying
No. It's called Roadcraft.
Video I watch.
It's called Roadcraft, and okay. It's like the trailer is a sandbox. It's these kids playing in a sandbox, and they've got like trucks and stuff, and there's a construction site behind them, and so they like playing with these trucks, and one of them knocks over a juice box and it spills, and then there's a huge crash, and he turns around and one of the trucks knocked over a water tower behind him, and then he starts like moving the truck around, and the truck in real life behind him is moving with it, and then realizes that he's controlling the construction site with the toys. And it's like, we'll get you in the kid part of you, like, I remember that feeling of like this, you know. It's a good trailer. The game is you are controlling construction vehicles and you get to like build roads and clear fields, and you know, like there's disasters that you have to go
destroy
in and
have to
figure out. No, you don't destroy farms, I don't think. You go in and you figure out how to like rebuild an area that has been devastated by a flood or something like that. So it's all, you know, like I get to use this crane to pick up this truck and put it on the other side of the river and then drive these materials to the thing. It just looks like, you know, kind of fun. And some people on Discord have talked about how much fun it is. But mainly that trailer, just like, I was like, oh, this is cool, because it's this kid realizing that he has control over this big stuff from these toys. That was neat, but
yes. One more honorable mention is Pee-wee as himself, the documentary.
Oh, I cannot wait to see that. Have you seen it?
There's two episodes, and we're three quarters of the way through the second one. It's so good. You get to see the creative process, and I love seeing other people's creative process, how something develops from nothing. It's so good.
Pee-wee is amazing. He's like a real part of everyone's childhood.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll put a link. Is it on HBO?
It's on HBO, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll watch that tonight, Rachel. I got two funny stories for the after show.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I guess that's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. And
thanks, guys.
We'll see you next time.
Bye. Bye. Love you.